You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 19th of December, 2015, on Monocle 24. After another year of publications defying predictions of a downturn, the capacity for growth among niche magazine titles has never looked better. But is there a flip side to this so-called golden age of print? Are magazines becoming a premium product? And is this such a good thing? That's coming up today on The Stack. On today's show, we're opening the covers of some selected premium titles as we discuss how rising standards are changing the industry at large. We'll also hear from the team behind an Austrian magazine that sets out to capture the unique voices of the city's creative community.
It was the possibility to have a platform where was you can write whatever you like. You can contribute in any sense you'd like to contribute and bring something that you were always thinking about and that you were always kind of like interested but never had the opportunity to publish.
Plus, architecture, landscapes and romanticism. We'll head to Tokyo for a leaf through the design savvy pages of Too Much.
It's about the relationship between like structures, buildings, landscapes and people and how all of those are related. And we're interested in thinking about the relations specifically through personal experiences.
So is there a growing divide between the weeklies and premium titles? That's coming up today on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Ben Ryland, sitting in for Tyler Brulé this week. I'm joined today by someone who really knows his magazines. He's the man behind the world's largest collection of them, James Hyman from the Hyman Archive. Welcome to The Stack. Now, I want to spend some time talking about premium titles today because, as we know, 2015 was another great year for the print industry. We saw some excellent new titles popping up, James, but we also saw another year of struggle for some of the world's better known weekly titles. First, perhaps, just explain to us your perception of what a premium title actually is.
I mean, to me, a premium magazine is something that you really do cherish, almost collect, merging almost to like a coffee book table. I mean, I even just today on the way here popped into a regular haunt, Wardour News, picked up some ones like Marfa Journal, Union. They are books. You know, they are hardback. They've really got rich content, content that you're not going to find easily online. You want that material. It's niche, it's tailored, it's well curated. You know, the digital revolution's made objects far more special and valuable. You think about it as well. Basically, producing a magazine is expensive. You know, going around, the photo shoots, the content, putting everything together compared to a quick tweet, a quick message on Facebook. So premium really is a physical thing that has rich content.
Now, premium magazines are something that we're seeing a lot more of now. And obviously, us here at The Stack, we get lots of premium magazines and lots of magazines of all types that come across our desks quite often. Now, that does lead me to think that we are actually now living in what could be called a golden age for publishing. It's a very positive news story. But then the flip side of that is that when we look at some of the more prestigious news weeklies that have been around for generations, they're still struggling. So why do you think that there is this golden age, but then also this sort of what a lot of people call the deterioration of the print industry happening simultaneously?
Again, I mean, I think that there's so much online now. I mean, I was comparing it to, it's almost like, you know, when you go to those restaurants and you see the plastic food in there, it's that you're not going to get that plastic food. That's what you get almost digitally. Physically, there is, again, it's this care and attention put to it. And in terms of the news, I think, again, all that news material, like those Times, Newsweek's Life, it's all online. That there's no, in their real golden eras, they would go and, let's say, have those photojournalists get those special shots. Everyone's got the cameras. Everyone can capture all this media and report it. So that's easily shared online. But, you know, with a golden age now in these, as I say, premium magazines, they really are caring for that content. That content is really thought about. News content, to me, is very easily accessible and shared quickly. There's nothing unique about it.
So if as you say, that news is very accessible now, which as far as the flow of communication goes, that's got to be a positive thing. But it does change somewhat the product that's being sold here, doesn't it? Because we've got these premium magazines, and most of the time they don't sell news. They sell something a little less specific.
You're absolutely right.
It's a lifestyle.
It is a lifestyle. I think it's a lifestyle. It's tribe. It's being part of something, feeling, again, part of it, you know, I guess harking back to those when you got the Face magazine, you felt you belonged. And these, you know, you really feel part of a movement. There's ownership in that. You know, again, I mean, you know, look, I like Time, I like Newsweek, I like your general magazine, I love those weeklies and the regular ones, but is there really that belonging? Is that sense of excitement about picking them up and, you know, reading them at leisure? I don't think so.
Do you think then that if those magazines were to push ahead and become more relevant, I mean, we could say remain relevant, but I would argue that some of them at least have sort of ceased to become, have ceased the spot of relevance that they once had. I mean, what is, in your view, what is that going to take to turn some of those titles around and maybe cut through a lot of the noise that we're hearing these days?
I think they need to adapt to the media out there. I mean, a good example, again, one of my all-time favourites is The New Yorker. So they'll tackle news, but they'll write it well. They'll really investigate it. They'll give good perspective. They won't just simply report a Reuters AP feed. It will be like, here's a personal take on it. They will integrate video into their website, podcasts. There's even podcasts they talk about the cartoons in the magazine. So again, it's giving you that feeling of belonging to something special, like you're part of a club. And that's it. That makes it premium, giving you more value, not your bog standard. Here is a story that you all know about.
See, you and I would say that, but then that doesn't seem to be the direction that a lot of the larger companies are going in. I mean, we recently, earlier in the year, heard from some of the influential people behind some of the larger weeklies over at the FIP event in Toronto, and they were putting a lot of focus on their digital operations. So it sort of seems as though print, for them, has become less relevant, and they've accepted that to some degree and are now moving in a different direction. So that sort of that suggests the possibility that perhaps a lot of these prestigious titles have just accepted that print is becoming a premium product and they're no longer interested in that.
That could be a way, and I mean, that's a shame. They can take that approach. There's nothing wrong in that approach. They can exist. But to me, rich, exciting, well thought out, curated, premium content can be applied to your mass market titles or your indie titles. In the same way, actually, that an indie, a zine, could be very rawly produced and scrappy and very disposable. But I just get the impression from all these premium magazines I tend to buy, see, digest, there was so much love and attention put into them and value that they do supersede those mainstream mass market titles who are just saying, okay, we're just going to do some concentrate on digital.
So with that in mind, do you think that magazines going forward will essentially become a premium product in many people's eyes? And is that a bad thing?
I think they will, and I don't think it's a bad thing because, again, I mean, they are out there now and they exist. They are, as I started here, they're becoming like books, and books are treasured, collectible. Look at these. I mean, just two here again. Martha Journal, and I'm not going to say that F word, but Effing Young, and Union. They're books. They're hardback. They are like a coffee table book. I would put that on my coffee table. I would not probably put those mainstream weeklies as a coffee table. So it is a very good thing. I mean, it's not like these. Again, I walk into Wardour News today and I see racks and racks. In fact, I see more premium, probably 90% premium in that shop, than I do 10% your regulars.
And when you buy a magazine like that, it does suggest something that that brings with it longevity. They're not there to be disposed of. They're not there to entertain you for a week and then be used as the kiddie litter liner. They're there for the long term.
Spot on. I mean, again,
and they're perfect for people like you, collectors.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, you don't have to be a collector, but you can certainly value what you're reading. I mean, look, this Martha Journal, I simply bought this for two things. On the headline, Lana Del Rey and Larry Flynt. Where are you going to read a really good... I haven't opened it yet. I'm debating whether I do open it or keep it sealed, as I often do. But, you know, great, yeah, that will take time to digest. That's like delayed gratification. Again, another one. That is targeted for you to really take time, read and savour that, and not just like a Metro newspaper on the tube, read it for a second and chuck it.
So what does this mean for publishers, though, taking this in more of an industry direction? Because if we are talking about premium titles, there's a lot more care that goes into them. The bar is set higher. The challenge is then a lot harder. Does that mean it is going to be harder to succeed in the publishing industry? Because if something is designed to be kept, then that means that a lot more care has to go into its
Correct.
Creation.
Again, it's that theory of media Darwinism, only the strong survive. You make sure you find your niche, you do it well, you put that real care, better it. And lots of people do that and still continue to do that. I mean, it can be done and it will be done. You've just got to make those things good premium products.
James, we'll come back to you in a moment, but for now, let's discuss Too Much magazine over in Tokyo, which is about romantic geography. It's made by a group of international writers and photographers. First hitting the shelves in 2010, the aim here is to gather thoughts about cities and the effect that they have on societies and our environment. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Cameron Allen McKean, co-founder of the magazine, who paid a visit to our Tokyo bureau.
The name Romantic Geography isn't exactly ours. We thought we had kind of invented it, but it turns out there's a few other people who've used it before. Some contemporary artists and researchers have used the name before. But for us, Romantic Geography was really about looking at our experience of the landscape and cities, personal experiences through stories, reflection, that kind of thing. Yeah, I guess it's about the relationship between like structures, buildings, landscapes, which can be, you know, the countryside, the city, and people, and how all of those are related. And we're interested in thinking about the relations not through like science or academia, but specifically through personal experiences.
I have your current issue here in my hands and esteemed Faked Mountains. I mean, can you tell us about why you choose the title and just a little brief, what stories can we find inside?
The title is for us kind of a reference to one of the main features in the magazine about an apartment block in China where the designer with an architect wanted to build a 16-story high fake mountain into the side of an apartment block. And for us, that became kind of a crude symbol for understanding what the kind of deeper issues that we were trying to explore in the magazine were. So initially, the magazine was about, well, we thought the magazine was going to be about gardens and the idea of man-made versions of nature. So there's a long history in Japan, I guess, of gardens that are replicating natural landscapes on a miniature scale. And we took that idea and tried to kind of expand it and think about like pot plant gardens in Tokyo and what that means about public and private space. And then from there, we also started to think about things like the Umi no Mori, which is a fake island in Tokyo Bay built by Terao Ando that has a man-made forest on it. And so from there, we started to think about all the possible ways we could address man-made versions of nature, so the artificial and the natural. And that just spiraled off into so many directions. And eventually, in the end, the issue came to be about this dissolving boundary between what is natural and what is man-made, that if we're at the state where we've actually been able to alter the climate and the global ecology, then what is natural and what is artificial anymore? The boundaries are blurring. So it was kind of a way of us exploring that, and by titling it A Fake Mountain was just kind of a simplistic, crude way of referencing all these wider ideas we were trying to address.
Finally, Cameron, what are your plans for Too Much for the future? Like, for example, when's the new issue coming out?
We actually just finished the new issue 3 or 4 days ago. So it's at the printers as we speak and should be back, I think, in a week or two. So for this one, we wanted to try something a little different, and we're looking at just one person and their work. And so we've started to think about what materials and resources mean and what our relationship with materials and resources is. And so for the next issue, we thought about the Himalayas as a resource. And that means a resource of experiences, a way that people can extract, you know, meaning from climbing Everest or these type of things. But also it means, you know, there's labor involved in that for Sherpas, There's a whole economic background to people's engagement with the mountain range and things like that. So we paired up with Naoki Ishikawa, who's a Japanese photographer, and looked at his images of the Himalayas and his experiences there. And that's going to be the first issue of a new series that just focuses on work.
Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco there, chatting to Cameron Allen at our Tokyo bureau. This is The Stack on Monocle 24. James Hyman is still with me. Now, we've been talking about some premium titles that have popped up over recent times. And James, you've brought in your own little collection here. Let's have a look.
So if we start, F-U-C-K-I-N-G, Young. It's bright. It grabs you. The word obsession. I can relate to that. I like the colours. It was premium. I love it.
Okay, so the name of the magazine, if you're a little bit too polite, cover your ears now, it's called Fucking Young. The magazine is clearly aimed towards the more creatively minded people. We've got someone on the cover who is, let's say they're bending their gender, whichever gender that might happen to be, and they're holding a birthday cake. The headline here, the attraction, is a bright yellow obsession. Now, that, of course, would speak to you, James. What was it exactly about this cover that made you want to pick it up? Because it's still in its plastic wrapping. You don't even know what's inside yet.
Absolutely. And I may buy another copy, one to open, one to keep, as you do when you're a serious collector. But it was, look, it screams at you in a lovely way. It's not noisy, but the colours are beautiful. Lots of pastel. Its headline, A Brief in Men's Fashion and Culture in 5 Chapters. And that word obsession, which obviously relates to me. But I thought, wow, grabbed me. That good.
Now, let's go through the other titles that you've brought in as well. And as you were saying before, a lot of them do seem more like books than magazines. And I don't think that would be any more true than in the case of Union, that other title you've got in front of you now.
That literally, for a second, I'm like, is that a book or a magazine? So here, it's just Fine Things Remain Timeless, very pertinent to what we're talking about. As moments elude us, the universal charm of truly the beautiful and exquisite will always entice. Timeless beauty is our essence and eternal philosophy. Nice poetic words to possibly sum up. Again, a magazine, book.
A hardcover magazine.
I just do not know, presented. But beautifully created.
We've got time for a few more. What's this one?
So again, I actually bought this. I mean, lovely image on the front of three ladies kind of posing and doing yoga in the sun. But I actually just bought it for two headline contents of this. Lana Del Rey, intriguing singer, and Larry Flint, of course, who was a magazine publisher in his own right for Hustler.
So this, of course, is another hardcover magazine, Marfa Journal. Tell me, what is the overall premise for this magazine? Because you were just saying before about how it is important for magazines now to be quite specific in what they're offering, whether it's a lifestyle, whether it's an overall brand, whether it's some sort of club that you want to belong to. That essence of wanting to belong to whatever the magazine is setting out to sell to you, that is important. What do you think this magazine is trying to lure you in with?
Its tagline is, you know, in it together experience, and I'm definitely part of a good in it together experience. If you've got something that's talking about Ozzy Osbourne, Larry Flint, and Lana Del Rey, and looks good and feels good, you can tell these people know their onions. So I'm sold.
You've got two more titles. Let's race through them quickly.
Very quickly. This one is not so much a book, but you know, premium. It costs £10. Gym Class,
with a beautiful sketch there of Anna Wintour.
Anna Wintour on the front. That's what got me. I thought they've done a nice little illustration here. It's all predominantly black and white. There's tons of kind of illustrations of New York magazine. And I mean, what's your gut when I'm just flicking through that?
A magazine inside a magazine.
Absolutely.
And one more.
Last one here is Flow. Its headline, again, got me. A magazine for paper lovers. Well, we love the physical. I love the artifact.
Made so, for us right here at The Stack.
There
clearly.
You go. So that got me. Lovely little illustration of a beautiful girl with rosy cheeks. Reminds me of my wife.
Now, of course, the subject of being a paper lover might, to some, come across as quite niche. But just that in particular is something that you could never get across online.
You can't. And in fact, in this thing, when I flick through, these kind of little fold-outs and personal timelines, and they're actually intricately woven, nice little fold-outs in this magazine, and real, you know, great, you can hear that noise there, the card, the paper they've done on it. You cannot ever get that online.
James Hyman from the Hyman Archive, the world's largest collection of magazines. Thanks very much for joining me today on The Stack. Coming up next, we'll hear from an Austrian magazine with a sharp focus on its national capital.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
This is The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Ben Rylan. We'll finish off today with a quick dash to the Austrian capital. A Priori magazine is the creation of design agency ES. From their studio in Vienna, the publication sets out to capture the unique voices of the city's creative community. With its sharp focus on typography and interesting images, A Priori is aiming to showcase Vienna as a key urban landscape for fresh and original thinking. But it's an increasingly crowded marketplace, and cutting through the noise can be a challenge. Well, I sat down for a chat with A Priori's Anna Berlin.
The whole idea about the magazine was, you know, that it didn't really have an issue or a subject, and it was really not about a theme, but more about the projects that we are involved and that we are kind of like connected to. We started the magazine as a communications company that we are doing, and together with a friend who is having a graphic studio. And so the project that found their way into the magazine was through projects that we work with and people whose work we liked. And then in the end, it all kind of like came across art and design and architecture and graphics and a bit of fashion, but also stories like we were, you know, talking to people who we know as journalists and who are, you know, writing about, you know, lots of things. And it was kind of like the option, or it was the possibility to have a platform where was you can write whatever you like. You can contribute in any sense you'd like to contribute and bring something that you were always thinking about and that you were always kind of like interested but never had the opportunity to publish. So that was kind of like the idea behind it, or the idea of the whole magazine. And then to find a title, that was kind of a tricky thing, as it might always be. So we came up with the phrase, a magazine on art, design, and the zeitgeist in Vienna and beyond, rather easily to kind of like capture a wide range and kind of, you know, make people curious and kind of have them on the right track, but still be open enough to that you're not too surprised to find a story on, I don't know, like the connection between high-end artists and sports people or something, or PR tips or handbags or, you know, all the things that we are covering in the magazine.
So that process that you mentioned there about going to your circle of colleagues and friends and contacts and getting them to come forward with their own ideas for concepts that could be put into the pages of the magazine, how important do you think that is to giving the magazine a feeling of authenticity and a vital insight into this particular pocket of Vienna?
With the response that we have with the magazine, and I mean, it's obviously not the only magazine that there is in the city, but it was basically everybody that we asked, and it was, you know, like old museums directors and free journalists and friends and high-profile photographers, but, you know, all range of people, but basically everybody was contributing. Everybody was very easy to convince. And it was like, there's no money involved. It takes time. It takes effort. But if you want to join in, it would be great. And that's kind of like all up to you. And that was surprising to us in the, you know, in the process, that everybody felt like an opportunity and not being forced into a subject. I'm not being forced into, we're doing something on a specific thing. And that was kind of like leaving it very open. And I don't know, I took it, you know, as an experience that usually if you ask the right people and if you're in contact with the right kind of circle of friends, as you said, or collaborators and people that we are involved with, the outcome is always good. I think it's more in the sense of like you have to make your selection before in like who you are asking to contribute, and then leave it up to them to decide on what they feel is kind of like the right thing to come forward with or bring into the project. And that turned out pretty well, as it seems. Also, I think that sometimes, I don't know how, you know, if everybody who is like seeing the magazine for the first time or for the readers, if it's really very comprehensive. So I think if we would do a magazine on a more regular base, we would have to be more comprehensive maybe. So we kind of like try to put in as much information that you need to understand the article, but that's somehow tricky. So I think, you know, if you have a magazine that's more dedicated to a theme, to subject, it's easier as a reader. In this sense, it's more like creating an atmosphere or creating a feeling for a city and for the people who live in the city, but also asking people who are not in Vienna, but, you know, we have contributors from Berlin and people from Paris, and it kind of like creates a vibe more than to get information across. And that was kind of important to us, that it doesn't need to be anything. We don't need to serve any kind of expectations. I think that was very deliberating for us in the process of making the magazine.
It does actually feel like quite a carefully curated approach to representing that particular side of life in the city. And I quite like that there's a bit of a mixture of paper stock used as well. Some of it's glossy, some of it's not. And all of the photography contained therein does have quite a distinctive, I suppose you could say, unproduced look. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you cultivate that overall style of the magazine? How do you create that visual appeal?
Well, a very big part of that was done by Studio Ease, who are, you know, was the director of the whole visuals and the whole graphic design. And they are based in Vienna, and it's a small agency with, you know, small and bigger clients. It was fortunate that Fidrigoni, who, you know, was sponsoring the paper, and it's an old Italian paper manufacturer that's kind of like known within the art scene, I'd say. We convinced them to kind of like be part of the project and support us with the paper. So we kind of had a bigger range of possibilities in producing with different papers and like experimenting with different layouts. That was a very big part. That was actually Verena's choice in, you know, how to arrange the photography, how to arrange the percentage of text and pictures. And that was probably another experience for her that, you know, we were the ones who were kind of like editing all the content and, you know, bringing everything together and suggesting people. But in the end, she had a pile of content of text and photos, and it was absolutely up to her to decide on how to put it and how to design it. And it was not, usually you have your client, you have, you know, certain interests, and it has a certain hierarchy that you have to respect, and you don't have this kind of like freedom and liberty in arranging and just looking at a picture and not saying, well, this is a very important character on it, so I have to rather make it big. And it was more like, well, I like this picture, so it's going to be big, and I make it very small because it's like it's not as important. You know, that was another kind of like liberty that Rina had as the one who was in charge for the visual and the artistic look of the magazine. And I guess that's, again, you know, if you work with people who know kind of what they do and you leave it up to them and leave it open to them to kind of like create something new that doesn't necessarily need to be anything, and turn it just surprisingly well. Then we wanted to have something unusual. The story with the cover was we first thought of something rather graphic, rather only text and a bit more posh. And then Stephanie Mooshammer, who is the photographer, and I saw this picture that's on the cover, and it's a bit of a Sarah Lucas lookalike finger in an orange. And I saw this picture, and it was so catchy, and it was so, this got to be on the cover. It's not really fitting with the rest of the content, and it's not exactly what we thought of in the first place. But once you saw it, it just felt right. And those were the kind of decisions that we made a lot. It was like it came up, it was there, it felt like this is it, go with it. Fine.
That was my chat there with Anna Berlin at A Priori magazine in Vienna. And that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and editor, Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, then drop us a note over at info@monocle.com. We are back at the same time next week for a special one-hour edition, looking back at some of our best highlights from throughout 2015. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Ben Ryland. Until next time, enjoy the holidays and goodbye.